In Dublin, if someone's going around the place whinging and complaining, then they're called the moving crib. The real moving crib is on Parnell Square in the city, and it's where Eileen Dunn and the Godslot broadcast from on Christmas morning. They brought us the word of the week and the quote of the week. The word of the week came from a self-consciously creative chorister with the Palestrina Choir.
We've done a lot of stuff over the Christmas season. We have a carol service. We've done our National Concert Hall concert, which went fantabulous. Oh, sorry, that was an accident.
No, that's okay. That's a perfectly valid word, I'm sure, in the context.
And the quote of the week came from the same programme and from John Sheehan of the Dubliners.
One of my grandchildren, what they said about the magic of Santa Claus, an interesting perspective, the way a kid will see things from a totally different angle. He says, "Granny, did Santa Claus bring you loads of presents years ago when you were a little granny?" Isn't there a lovely wonder about that?
Excellent. The sound effect of the week also came from children, pupils of Goree Central School, talking to Cian McCormack on Morning Ireland on Christmas Eve.
Well, I think he flies around with his reindeer, Santa.
Would they have to go very fast?
Yes, because he has to get around the whole world.
How fast do you think they'd have to go?
Maybe a million miles an hour.
What would that sound like?
But we need silence as well as sound and radio. Our version of the white space between the words. And the best use of silence came from Audrey Donoghue's programme on St. Stephen's Night, in which she spoke to three young Irish people in their teens and 20s. One of those was the director of the film Pilgrim Hill, Gerard Barrett.
It's about a bachelor farmer in rural Ireland, more or less fighting isolation and loneliness. So we're here, we are now on top of the hill. When I was doing Pilgrim Hill, it was one of the things was I came up to the top of the hill and I just stood there and I just counted. There was a bachelor farmer there, there was one there, there was one there, there was one there, there was one there, and there was one there, and a bachelorette. And probably one of the most things that came to me when I was on top of the hill there was the silence. You know, if you are alone, it's the silence, and that's what I took into Pilgrim Hill. That's a part of the life that they have.
Gerard believes that there are two main issues concerning young Irish people at the moment.
I think a lot of my people, my own age and younger, we've identity crises at the moment. We've an identity kind of... I think what people, parents anyway, sometimes find it hard to understand is that sometimes we don't know what we want to do job-wise. And there's nothing wrong with that. I think it's important to kind of find your way and find your way into what career suits you and what you want to do with your life. I think that that's the biggest issue. And I also think the biggest issue as well is that, like, there's so many of my friends away in Australia and Canada and Dubai. They're all over the world. I speak to them on Skype. We talk on Facebook, whatever. They don't want to be away. It's like I have a friend in London now. And, you know, London's only an hour away. He lives back the road from me there. He's in London. He lives in a house with four Polish people, right? He's a qualified architect. He cannot get a job. He's working on a building site in London. And he comes home every evening and he makes his dinner and there's four Polish people there with him. They're all lovely people, but they're all speaking in their own language. He's there by himself, a lad from the Stole. He's totally lost in translation there. They're both there for obviously for economic circumstances. And he told me he goes up into his bedroom, he takes out his guitar and he sings a song and he cries every night.
Someone a bit more sanguine about emigration is Father Aidan Troy. He became famous during the Holy Cross school dispute in Belfast and was reposted to Paris. He was speaking to Colm Flynn on Christmas Eve in Paris and recalled how he was, too, a reluctant emigrant.
I was coming over on the flight about lunchtime on the 28th of September 2008 and one of the hostesses recognised me and she said to me, "You look awful sad. I know why you're sad." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because you've been transferred." She was from County Monaghan and she went up and she got me a beautiful little picture, a little holy picture, and she wrote her name on it and just said, "Best wishes," and came down to me and handed me and she said, "You'll do all right." And I thought, yeah, this is going to be all right eventually.
And has it been okay 6 years on in Paris?
Oh, it has been okay. It's like, you know, I remember my first Christmas being so lonely and thinking of the time since, probably when I'm leaving here, I'm going to be saying, "Do you know, I'm going to miss this place."
Father Aidan wants to get back to the North, whose politicians were in the news this week. The US diplomat Richard Haass was aiming to have a deal with them signed by Christmas Eve. It was to settle conflict over parades, flags, and dealing with the past. One view of the coverage could be that it was like hearing about a man trying to chivvy a bunch of children into a car hopped up on sweets after a visit to Santee.
The potential problem in it is that they're beginning to come to the microphones a little too much. They're beginning to maybe set out their positions to journalists before they get around the table among themselves. And that, of course, in turn is having an effect on the other side, because if unionists are saying they're happy, well, then nationalists are saying, well, are we losing? So if he manages to get them into the room, and I think now instead of the 11 o'clock start this morning, it's likely to be at 5 or 6 this afternoon, I think he has a very good chance of success if he can calm them down, get the focus going, and try and get them to make the jump together.
Tommy Gorman with Áine Lawler at lunchtime on Monday. Later in the day, things were stalling.
The reason for the delay today is the DUP wasn't around yesterday when the most recent document was circulated. They took Sunday off observing the Sabbath. They came in this morning. Then you had bilaterals between several of the parties. And because of that, matters just got shoved back. So far, no plenary session. And this is definitely going to run long into the night and the small hours of tomorrow morning.
Then, in the small hours of Christmas Eve morning.
RTE News at 4 o'clock with Nick Adams. Good morning. Negotiations in Belfast between the five main parties in the North and US diplomat Dr. Richard Haass have been suspended for Christmas. Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams said on Twitter in the past hour that good progress had been made, but expressed disappointment that an agreement could not be reached.
The difficulty of nation building. Richard Haass is reported to be coming back to Ireland today and will try for a New Year's Eve agreement. As if to emphasise that difficulty of nation building or to show how far things have come, news came through during the week from South Sudan of hundreds dying in intercommunity violence. South Sudan is the world's newest country, only 2 years old, and seems to be facing the tasks of many new countries, building trust between communities and avoiding civil war.
I was talking to one young South Sudanese guy, and he said, you know, people are now starting to ask who their neighbours are. And of course, what he means is they're wondering, are their neighbours their own tribal identity, or are they something different? Because if things go bad again, they want to know that there are people that they can trust. And that is what is at stake here, because this is a young country. The institutions of democracy are 2.5 years old. They're really being tested now. If people retreat into tribalism, if they feel that that is their safety and not the military, not the institutions, then this country could ignite into civil war.
Gregory Warner on Morning Edition on RTE Radio and Extra, our sister digital station. What's the line about we make plans and God laughs? You would have thought of that when listening to the late Colm Murray last Saturday night. Colm, who died this year, was interviewing Alex Ferguson, who retired this year.
The timing, do you know, and I say this all the time, I made a mistake some years ago because I thought my 60th birthday is a good time to retire. I'd done everything. You can at United, won a European Cup. Maybe it's time for a younger one. But then my family get in about me. My wife says, you're off your head. Do you think I'm going to be having you about my feet in this house, you know, in your life? So I went back, my tail between my legs, to Maurice Watkins, the club lawyer, and I said, look, I've changed my mind. And they started to laugh. He said, why did you do it in the first place? And they'd already approached one, it's Sven Eriksson, to take the job. So I says, I know, it's his, Maurice, I says, my family got off her head. And he just laughed. He says, okay. And that was it. So I stayed. Now, having done that at that time, and you get older, I'm 69 and next week, you say to yourself, what happens when you retire? What do you do, you know? Because I said to the wife sometimes, I said, well, we can always travel. She said, what are we going to do? I said, we can travel. She says, but you need your health to travel. You need to be fit to travel. You know, you just kind of, at our age, think you can jump on a plane every week, you know? And I said, well, that's a fair point. I agree with you there. And I get to the stage now and I say to myself, well, retirement's for young people. And I made that statement some weeks ago. And I thought about it and I said, so, because now those pals I'm talking about up in Glasgow, one of them retired about 10 years ago. And he travels all the time, you know, he's all over the place and he's terrific, it's great, it's his life. But you can do something when you're younger. You know, you can do something else. You take another challenge or you can do another interest, but you can do something because you've got your youth. Some people retire at 50, you know, people in, maybe in the police or the army, you know, they retire younger. But they have to do something. They take on maybe security jobs and things like that. And that's where I'm not, there's no plan for me at the moment to retire, Colm. There's no plan.
Alex Ferguson talking to the late Colin Murray in an interview recorded 2 years ago. Mark Little had a sort of a retirement. He left Primetime and RTE to set up an online service called Storyful. This week, Storyful was sold for €18 million to Rupert Murdoch. Mark came into Sean O'Rourke on Monday. He explained that one of the things the company does is verify videos and images that appear on YouTube and social media sites. Before news organisations use that material, Storyful tries to make sure that it isn't fake or propaganda. That's the first thing they do.
The second thing we do is we pass it on to our clients, who range from the New York Times to BBC, ABC News, all over the world. We also allow them to monetize, to make some money out of this stuff, and to pass it back to the people who create the video. So it's the first sort of ethical business model for video that's out there on these big social platforms, whether it be news video or just the kind of video you want to share with your kids, you know, to make them laugh. And it's that range of video we do.
To take some of the big news stories of the last couple of years since you started, for instance, the civil war in Syria, what were you able to do and throw up from that?
So it's really interesting. I mean, we've worked with everybody from the big news organizations to the International Criminal Court, because what we're watching now emerging from Syria is the first time in history that a war has been recorded in real time, as it happens, from both sides. And we can see a more authentic version of what's going on the ground than I could when I was a correspondent in Afghanistan or Iraq, as long as we can verify what we see. And that's the key difference between us and I think other news organizations. And we have people who spend hours trying to work out the shadows in a video, see if it's morning or it's evening. We have constant conversations, communities online who help us verify things like dialect and accent. And this is what we do every day, spending hours on that. So that's an example of what we would do in Syria, in the Boston bombing, the coverage there, for example. We're the ones who are out there trying to warn people against taking hoaxes or erroneous information. So in our newsroom, ironically, we're the ones that love the idea of stopping a story as much as starting one.
You won't be surprised that people have been tweeting, texting, and
not at all,
asking questions along the lines of what's... I'm going to sort of just finesse this question a little bit. Does an old student radical like you, or a former student radical like you, have any qualms at all about dealing with Mr. Murdoch?
No. I mean, I think this is something we thought about as well. For me, the most important thing was, would I be able to take control and maintain personal responsibility for my own ethics, for my values? Could I actually walk into the, you know, this News Corp group and say, yes, I have control of the company, but more importantly, you know, I defend the open and collaborative methods that I use. The things that have always inspired me since I was that student radical have been change, dynamic innovation. And that's what I found when I went to News Corp, is that whatever people think about Murdoch's, you know, empire, there's also this part in this company that's like a startup. But most of all, Sean, the final thing I'd say is, this is a great result, I think, for the Irish startup scene. I mean, the biggest single beneficiary of this deal is the Irish taxpayer, who walk away, we think about it, about €8 million out of this deal will go into the Exchequer's pocket. And I would love to see a lot of that money going back to startups like us, like myself.
Mark Little with Sean O'Rourke on the success of his startup, Storyful. Eric Bell knows all about startups. He was part of an Irish startup called Thin Lizzy. Eric was a guitarist with the band 40 years ago in 1973. Things were bad. They were struggling to get a hit. They had booked time in a studio, but nothing was working out for them. Well before the end of the session, they put down their instruments and were discussing calling it a day.
And Philip said, we're staying today, it was another hour and a half to go. So Philip picked up the guitar, up to the microphone, started singing all these stupid songs, just taking the piss. And me and Brian sitting there reading, not taking any notice of Philip. So Phil starts singing Whiskey in the Jar. He's got on to this then. It's always going over, according. And we started messing about. I didn't have that riff, obviously. We're playing this and all of a sudden the door opens and Ted Carroll, one of our managers, walks in. And Ted Carroll says, have you got a song for the single coming up? No. I think you should work on that song, Whiskey in the Jar. And we're looking at him like, what are you talking about, man? We left Ireland to get away from this, and you wanted to record it as a single? I don't think so. He says you should think about it. So Sorry, but we eventually got to the studio, but 5-6 weeks later, and we still weren't sure of Whiskey in the Jar. So we recorded Black Boys in the Corner, great track. It came out great. So then we says, right, what are we going to do for the B-side? I don't know. What do you think? I don't know. This little voice comes on.
Why don't you try Whiskey in the Jar?
Okay. So we went out. Me and Philip had two acoustic guitars, Brown on the drums, and we went, one. And that was it until the end. And then Phil put the vocals on. The drums was already on. Right, Eric, I said, what are you going to put on the guitar? I don't even know where to start. I hadn't a clue. I had no idea what to do. Where do you start? Or something like that. No. So one night we're coming home from a gig and it's about 2:30 in the morning and we're still really tired and we've about another half hour to go to get to London, to get to our beds. And Phil always played cassettes in the car. And we're all smoking as usual. And he had this mixture of music. He had Bob Marley, Jimi Hendrix, ZZ Top, The Chieftains, just this rigmarole of all different types of music. So away in the background, I'm hearing The Chieftains. And all of a sudden, I start hearing the Irish pipes. The start of Whiskey in the Jar. I copy Irish pipes instead of a guitar. So after about a week, I come up with... like pipes, that... Yeah.
Only one thing better than a good piece of music, and that's a good musician rhapsodising about it. Eric Bell, the Thin Lizzy guitarist from Danny Carroll's documentary Whiskey in the Jar, the Eric Bell story from St. Stephen's Day on Radio 1. Success in the music business was the subject of the radio play last Sunday night at 8 in Drama on 1. Well, it was actually a musical, Egypt of Love, featuring Amy Creighton and Paul Reed.
Billy, I'm sorry for leaving you like that.
It's all right.
Are you seeing anyone?
No, been too busy digging.
Because maybe, Billy, if you're around, like, I mean, if you had time, you could come over. And we could share a package of salty wedgies or something.
I'd love to, Eileen. But I can't. It's not you.
It's okay, Billy. I understand.
No. It's just that I promised Ma. Eileen? Eileen?
She moves a little here. She moves a little there. She has nice clothes. She has nice hair. She smiles the perfect smile. She knows just what to say. There's a camera up her skirt. She's on a diet every day. Everybody loves a pretty girl. Everybody wants to take her home. Everybody loves a pretty girl. But she loves only one. Makeup, perfect skin and bone. she loves only one. But she loves only one. She moves a little here, she moves a little there.
Now, what about that weather?
Oh, it's so cold. Where are we?
Oh, we're going to be in so much trouble.
Why?
Because RTE Junior Radio, they sent us all the way to Lapland in the North Pole to deliver a message to Santa Claus, and look at us, we're lost.
Oh, don't worry, Colm, we'll be fine. Hey, Colm, I can see smoke over there. It's got to be a house, Colm. Please, let's check it out. Woohoo, look, I'm almost here. Come on, Colm, hurry up, hurry up.
The RTE Junior Radio play, Searching for Santa, from last Sunday morning, with Emma O'Driscoll and Colm Flynn. Colm was on Radio 1 presenting Rising Time during the week, but this time dealing with actual bad weather.
Now, we're getting lots of texts in about trees and branches down here, there and everywhere, so please do take care. I know that I've mentioned this a few times, but just conscious that people are tuning in all the time. Even myself, when I was driving here from Ennis this morning, there were a few branches down in some of the smaller secondary roads. Colm, road blocked, Tralee to Listowel from Jim.
So while some programmes had spokespeople from ESB Networks and Met Aaron, others brought the news of the storms through texts from listeners.
A text in here from Richard the Thatcher in North Cork near Charleville. He says, no power here since last night either. No lights, no heating, no TV, no internet at the moment. Fridge and freezer off, no kettle or cooker. Hopefully it'll be sorted soon enough. He says he's going out to cover my stack of thatching reed that got blown around in the storm last night. And from Donegal, from Northwest Donegal in Gweedore, they say, well, this particular texter says, things are okay. I can't understand, though, how people are not prepared. I have battery-operated lanterns, also gas fires and mini cooker for this possibility. Reminds me of the olden days when the lights go off. Of course, I understand how inconvenient it is, really, but people should be more prepared. Yes, indeed.
John Murray yesterday morning. The other running story during the week was retail sales. According to the shops, sales were down marginally before Christmas and up spectacularly just after. It seems to be an inexact science predicting the shopping patterns of people, and a science that's been inexact for a long time, if you're to believe the History Show. They did a programme on Sunday about Christmas 100 years ago in 1913. Dublin was in the middle of the lockout. Louise Denver's report featured Stephanie Rains from NUI Minute.
I'm absolutely sure that it was not a good trading year, and the big department stores that would have relied more on the better off suburban customers would have suffered because of the lack of transport, because the trams weren't running, and the trams brought the majority of the customers in from the suburbs.
But while many workers were on strike, the upper middle class spent days and evenings shopping for Christmas gifts on Grafton Street.
Grafton Street was the place to see and be seen in terms of shopping, and I think that would probably have been particularly true of Switzers and of the fashionable cafes like Cafe Cairo. Switzers were in the building that is now Brown Thomas, and Brown Thomas were in the building that is now Marks and Spencers. And they would have been great rivals, there's no doubt about that. They would have been competing for the same, more prosperous customers.
And while the department stores catered for the upper classes, they also sold stock that would find a home with those affected by the lockout.
I think that one of the key differences of the things that people shopped for is that as well as shopping for gifts for their friends and family and decorations like trees for their homes, they actually did do more charitable shopping. And the stores catered to that in a specialist way by having special departments that bought in large quantities of relatively cheap woolen clothing or cheap woolen blankets that would have been sold not to the poor themselves, but to the middle classes who then gave it away, because you were expected to do that at Christmas. You were expected to give away to those less well off than yourself.
Stephanie Rains from Louise Denver's report on the History Show last Sunday.
There's a certain slant of light winter afternoons that oppresses like the heft of cathedral tunes. Heavenly hurt it gives us. We can find no scar, but internal difference where the meanings are. None may teach it any. 'Tis the seal despair, an imperial affliction sent us of the air. When it comes, the landscape listens, shadows hold their breath. When it goes, 'tis like the distance on the look of death.
Juliet Stevenson reading Emily Dickinson's There's a Certain Slant of Light. That poem featured on a programme from Ethna Hand with the title For Making This Spacewalk Possible. It went out on Stevens's Night on Radio 1. That quote, For Making This Spacewalk Possible, is from the late Seamus Heaney. He was describing how poetry allowed him to walk on air. Curiously, this week there was quite a bit of space talk. While the ESB teams were fixing the transformers down here, NASA astronauts were fixing a cooling pump on the space station up there. The British Met Office announced they are starting to issue forecasts for the weather in space because of its impact on communications and technology down here. The Canadian astronaut Chris Hadfield's new book came out, and the opening line reads, "The windows of a spaceship casually frame miracles." And this week is the 45th anniversary of one such window casually framing a miraculous sight that had a huge impact back here. The picture of the Earth rising over the moon's surface.
The Earthrise photo came about by accident. Frank Borman, the mission commander, was in the process of rotating the spacecraft, and it just so happens that as they came around, Bill Anders could see the Earth coming up through his side window. This had happened three previous times on Apollo 8, but their windows were facing away from the Earth. So it wasn't until Borman made this maneuver that they actually could see it for the first time. And I got to tell you one little human moment that came about that Anders told me about when he saw the Earth coming up. He said his mind was sort of divided between, my God, that's the prettiest thing I've ever seen, and thinking about having to get back there. And he thought to himself, my God, I hope we hit that thing.
Andrew Chaikin on Christmas Eve on RTE Radio 1 Extra on the 45th anniversary of the taking of the famous photo of the Earth rising over the moon's surface. It made people realise the fragility of the planet. A reminder, I suppose, that space exploration wasn't so much about learning about what's out there, but getting a different perspective on what's back here. A bit like what they say about travel, giving you a different view on where you're from, although the childish Kate Kerrigan wouldn't agree. As she told the Sunday Miscellany audience in the National Concert Hall, their Christmas travel was a disaster. They were brought back from their home in England to visit their granny in the west of Ireland.
On Christmas Eve, all us kids were put to bed in the back room, a damp extension that was built in the 50s and only used during the summer months. The one thing it had going for it was bunk beds, but I had to move from the top bunk because the springs were starting to give and my mother was afraid my weight might cause them to skewer my younger sister beneath me in the night. Me and my brother went into the roll-out sofa bed, which was ancient and rock-hard and smelt slightly musty and had scratchy Foxford Woolen Mills blankets. I wanted to be in the small bedroom we called the pocket, where I usually slept, but the adults needed all the rooms to accommodate Cullum and Jean, who were not married. So they had to sleep in separate rooms at opposite ends of the house.
John McKenna's Christmases were spent at home, but it didn't make them any less fraught. In the same Sunday Miscellany programme, he recalled the Christmas tradition of taking down the decorations and discovering that the Christmas tree lights weren't working or that they blew a fuse. John was sent down the road by his mother to fetch Andy Kelly, a man in possession of electrical wisdom.
And I'd traipse along the terrace, wondering why I always got the job, and speculating on the ill-timed magic that ensured the lights went from working perfectly on January 6th of any year to not working on December 24th of the same year, when they had spent the intervening period resting in a box in the attic. Was there some malevolent sprite up in the dark roof space, so bored that he spent the summer and autumn months unscrewing bulbs and loosening wires. And so I'd knock on Kelly's door and explain the situation, and Mrs. Kelly would tell me that her husband would be down in a minute. And sure enough, Andy would arrive in no time, find the fault, and mend the fuse with a piece of silver paper from his cigarette packet. Just for the time being. And promise to have a look at the fuse board once we get over the Christmas.
Getting over the Christmas these days usually involves thoughts of the gym, which prompted Carl Spain's observations in yesterday's comedy quiz, Don't Quote Me.
Gerry Adams, the mention of Gerry Adams always upsets me, not because of any political thing, but because that's what the lads call me in the gym, because even though I've been a member for years, no one can prove it.
Christmas is about the same thing every year, a sort of happy Groundhog Day, and that's what people like about it. But every so often, there's a surprise, something different. Like the woman on Liveline's Christmas Eve show from Dublin City Centre, who introduced us to the Australian Carol.
Where are you from yourself?
I'm from Sydney, Australia.
Oh my God.
I've just come to sing for you, Joe.
I doubt it somehow or other.
I have.
I'm not playing your airfare. And can you sing?
I can.
Well, we've had a Deste Fidelis, Askelga from Beaumont, Angela, who did Honours Irish in her leaving, didn't you, Angela? Yeah, I did Honours Mála myself. And is there an Australian carol?
There is. Well, I'm going to sing for you the Three Drovers, just a verse of it now.
The Three Drovers, okay.
Yeah.
From all the way from Sydney, Australia. Yeah. Catherine O'Doherty.
Across the plains on Christmas night, three drovers riding blithe and gay, looked up and saw a starry light, more radiant than the Milky Way. And on their hearts such wonder fell, they sang with joy, Noel, 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 Noel.
Catherine from Sydney with Joe Duffy on the Christmas Eve show from Grafton Street in Dublin. That show was a Christmas tradition from the Gay Byrne days, kept alive by the Liveline team. Another Christmas tradition from the Gay Byrne show days that has been revived by the Godslot programme is the reading of what has become known as the Virginia editorial. It was written by the editor of the New York Sun newspaper in 1897 in response to a letter from an 8-year-old girl whose friends were querying the existence of the man in the red suit.
Virginia, your little friends are wrong. They have been affected by the skepticism of a skeptical age. They do not believe except they see. They think that nothing can be which is not comprehensible by their little minds. All minds, Virginia, whether they be men's or children's, are little. In this great universe of ours, man is a mere insect, an ant in his intellect, as compared with the boundless world about him, as measured by the intelligence capable of grasping the whole of truth and knowledge. Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus. He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist, and you know that they abound and give to your life its highest beauty and joy. Alas, how dreary would be the world if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as dreary as if there were no Virginias. There would be no childlike fate then, no poetry, no romance to make tolerable this existence. We should have no enjoyment except in sense and sight. The eternal light with which childhood fills the world would be extinguished. Not believe in Santa Claus. You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch in all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? Nobody sees Santa Claus, but that is no sign that there is no Santa Claus. The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not. But that's no proof that they're not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders that are unseen and unseeable in the world. You may tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived, could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance, can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernal beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world, there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus. Thank God he lives, and lives forever. 1,000 years from now, Virginia, nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood.
Jerry McArdle from the Godslot programme on Christmas morning, reading from the New York Sun editorial of 1897, addressed to 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon. If it's seasonal gladness you want, it burst out of the radio yesterday morning when John Murray had two members of the Cavan band The Stripes on, Pete O'Hanlon and Evan Walsh, both 17 years of age. This weekend they're playing 3 sold-out gigs in Cavan Town.
Yeah, in the town hall. It's going to be great. There's people flying like from all over England and Europe and everything to come over and see us, in Japan and everything. So
fantastic.
And all descending on Cavan.
Yeah, you're putting Cavan on the map. So 2014, what I presume a lot of your schedule is already set up, but tell us, give us some idea, Evan, of what you're going to be up to.
Well, we're going to America in January for a short enough stay to do a couple of shows. And just it'll be our first experience for all of us going to America and seeing places like, you know, New York and Los Angeles and wherever we're going as well. Just keep, as Pete said earlier, plugging away and hoping for the best.
Yeah, and of course, that's been the big thing with bands over the years. A lot of Irish and British bands have failed to crack it in the States. Is that a big goal for you now, or a big ambition?
To fail.
to succeed, should I say.
I don't know, you can't really set your sights and succeed, and you kind of just, as I've said, and I said, I've paraphrased me, hope for the best, kind of.
Yeah.
You can't really have too much high expectations, because it's such a huge country, and however many million people live there.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's just hope for the best.
And we should also mention the two other lads, Ross Farrelly and Josh McClory.
Oh, we don't need to talk with them.
You don't? Yeah, it must be, you know, a bit like living the dream, is it?
Yeah, well, a bit like living the dream with your friends, like, so it's just as good. Like,
yeah. There's not much of a dream to be lived, though, at the same time, as in we didn't really have this aspiration of, you know, being big or being famous or whatever. It just feels like, you know, this is something we like doing and we kind of get on with it.
Yeah. And I suppose you're delighted, in a way, that you're putting Cavan on the map.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And not that it wasn't there already, but, you know, you're given that you're all from Cavan.
It wasn't like New York now.
Pardon?
It wasn't like New York at all.
No.
I don't know, lots of New York people would envy Cavan. Two of the Stripes talking to John Murray yesterday morning. Here's one of their songs, You Can't Judge a Book by the Cover.
Can't judge an apple by looking at the tree. You can't judge honey by looking at the bee. You can't judge a daughter by looking at her mother. You can't judge a book by looking at the cover.
The young Cavan band The Stripes, who appeared on the John Murray Show yesterday morning. Mickey Doherty would like their style. A recording of one of his stories was played on Arena last night in a programme about Irish storytelling. In Mickey's story, if you want to get to Carnegie Hall, you don't need to practice.
There was an old fiddle player one time lived in Glenfinn, and he only had the 2 tunes. But he was asked to go to a dance to Letterhillo, a town land they call Letterhillo. And on his way going, he had the fiddle with him, and he didn't care for going, he only had the 2 tunes. And as he was going along a lonely part of the road, there come a wee red-haired man out afore him, and the wee man asked him where he was going. He said he was going to a dance in Letterhillo, when he would far rather not go and count to him only having the 2 tunes, and he knowed there would be a big crowd there, and it would be hard to play them in music. So the wee man says he to him, what kind of a fiddle, he says, have you with ye? So he took the fiddle out from under his coat, and he showed the fiddle to the wee man, and the wee man examined her. And he run his fingers across the strings, three times, and he handed the fiddle back to them. "Well, go on," says he, to this fiddle player. "Says he, go on," he says, "and don't be cowardly," he says, "and go into the dance," he says, "the night," he says, "there'll be no other fiddle player there," he says, "lucky." So on he went, and when he came into the dance house, there was a very big crowd. He took his set to play for them, and when he drew out the fiddle, he drew the bow on her, and she was twice as loud, and there wasn't a tune of 100 tunes but he had.
Mickey Doherty, storyteller from last night's Arena programme about storytelling and the Irish. One of the best of the breed was, of course, Oscar Wilde, and all this week on The Book on One, his short stories were featured. On Monday, the late David Kelly read The Selfish Giant, the story of a giant who walled up his garden so that children couldn't play in it. And because children couldn't play in it, the spring stayed away and left the garden to the snow and the north wind. Until one morning, the giant heard birdsong and jumped out of bed and ran to the window.
He saw a most wonderful sight. Through a little hole in the wall, the children had crept in, and they were sitting in the branches of the trees. In every tree that he could see, there was a little child. And the trees were so glad to have the children back again that they'd covered themselves with blossoms and were waving their arms gently above the children's heads. The birds were flying about and twittering with delight, and the flowers were looking up through the green grass and laughing. It was a lovely scene. Only in one corner, it was still winter. It was the farthest corner of the garden, and in it was standing a little boy. He was so small that he could not reach up to the branches of the tree, and he was wandering all around it, crying bitterly. The poor tree was still covered with frost and snow, and the north wind was blowing and roaring above it. "Climb up, little boy," said the tree, and it bent its branches down as low as it could, but the boy was too tiny. And the giant's heart melted as he looked out. "How selfish I've been," he said. "Now I know why the spring could not come here. I will put that poor little boy on the top of the tree, and then I will knock down the wall, and my garden shall be the children's playground for ever and ever." He was really very sorry for what he had done.
David Kelly reading The Selfish Giant from The Book on One on Monday night on RTE Radio 1. To finish, music. This is from Scott Radio na Gaeltachta on Saturday night at 8 on Radio 1. The programme featured the folk music of Ireland and Scotland, and this spirited piece is from Blair Douglas, Kate Martin's Waltz.